I actually liked the flowers when they were right up here. I thought I looked a bit like the dearly departed, you know. But well, good evening, everybody. My name is Lorna, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. And thank you for that rousing welcome. And thank you so much for inviting me here to Georgia to speak. I know you have a choice of many speakers, and so it's not lost on me what a privilege it is to be asked. And, you know, very often a speaker will say, I hope there's something I can share that's helpful to you this evening. Well, I'm not here to help you at all. It would be very arrogant of me to think that I could help you. It's, I'm here because God thinks I need an awful lot of help. And I'm given the opportunity to share and to have myself reflected back and to hear my story again. So, a few years ago, you know, the original... Oh, first of all, before I forget my manners, thank you so much for the committee. Thank you so much for Carol. She's been absolutely wonderful to Janice and myself. Janice came with me from New York because I have a bit of a health condition. And so she has accompanied me here. And thank you for the committee for the wonderful bag in my room that had all sorts of goodies in it. So I'm very appreciative. A few years ago, the original manuscript of the big book came up for sale at Sotheby's. Sotheby's is one of the two major auction houses in New York. And this manuscript had been given by Lois to someone that had helped her a great deal. And that someone became old and he needed money for hospital and medical bills and things. So he put this manuscript up for sale. And the manuscript expert at Sotheby's knew that it was a very important document and gave it a description and place in the catalogue befitting its importance. He knew it was a piece of American historical document. And I think it had about 5 or 6 pages in the catalogue devoted to the description of it and all that and lots of pictures. And there was a very healthy estimate on it. I think the estimate was something like 20 to 30,000 or 30 to 50, something like that. And, but it was in a catalogue with many other manuscripts. And the day of the sale came, and it wasn't held in the main sales room, this manuscript sale. It was held in one of the subsidiary galleries. And it was packed with AAs. And anyway, this thing came up for sale, and the gavel went down at just over 1.5 million. And there were gasps in the room, and you know, all the AAs were hugging each other and weeping, and you know, and I was in the auction business, and I am an auctioneer myself. And I watched the auctioneer, and he was not the person who was the expert. He was not the cataloger. He was just the auctioneer. And I saw him turn to the record keeper, and he said, "Did this guy write anything else?" One more story. I was telling Carol and Janice this today, that in a meeting not so long ago, I heard a fellow, they were asking for day counts. And he said, "I had 72 days. He said, but I drank last night, so now I've only got 71. And that. And no one was going to disavow him of it. You know how much we cling to our days. Well, I've got 70 days of drinking, but I've got 30 days of smoking cigarettes, and I haven't had a snort of Coke for 5 days. And, you know, everything is so important, though. So, you know, all right, you've got 70 days. That's wonderful. Terrific. Or 71 days, whatever it is. Anyway, so I guess you're wondering when I'm ever going to get to my story, but I have a very long story now. I used to have a very short story, but now the weight of it is in sobriety rather than... But this is it for my experience. I was... my husband had finally walked out the door, and I thought it was the most fascinating thing he'd ever done. It really... it really caught my attention. So I was terribly, terribly unhappy, terribly, and I desperately wanted him back. And through a set of circumstances, this girlfriend of mine said to me, you know, Lorna, last night I went to a meeting of Al-Anon, and all the women sounded just like you. And she started talking about alcoholism and people that are alcoholics, and something clicked. I thought, oh my God, he's an alcoholic. That's what it is. And so the very next night, I wasn't one to mess around or waste time. The very next night, I too went to an Al-Anon meeting. And it was suggested at this meeting, which I found fascinating, that one go to open AA meetings. So the night after that, which was a Thursday night, I had called up into group, and I found that there was a meeting actually just up the road from where I worked. It was on 90th Street. It was a meeting called Lenox Hill. And after work that particular Thursday, it was an open meeting so that people like myself who were not alcoholics could attend. And after the work that day, I did what I had done many, many times, is I went across the road to the Carlisle Hotel. And in the Carlisle Hotel was Bemelman's Bar. And it was a very fancy, it wasn't a bar, it was a cocktail lounge, don't you know? And so I'm there, and I did what I like to do. I like to fast all day. I called it working hard. I like to fast all days, and I like to have that first vodka and orange juice on an empty stomach. Woof! You know, I don't want to eat the peanuts. I don't want to talk to the bartender. I don't want to have polite conversation. I want that woof drink. So I had my first two vodkas and orange juice, and then the evening went on, and I said to my friends, ooh, it's almost 7:30. I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be back. And so I toddled up the road to this meeting that was, of course, in a church hall, and I walked in, and sure enough, it was an open meeting. And I looked around, I thought, well, I wonder who are the alcoholics in here? You know, I had no idea. Anyway, it was a three-speaker meeting, and the first fellow got up on the stage, and he stood at a podium much like this one, and in front of the podium was a board. And on the board was that sort of Gothic AA writing, and it said, but for the grace of God, dot, dot, dot. So I suppose we in the audience or the group were supposed to look at this poor fellow up there and realize that but for the grace of God, we could be that poor wretch, you know? And anyway, he told this fascinating story. I mean, I was laughing, and I was moved, and I all the right, you know, emotions I had no idea I was identifying. I just thought it was so fantastic. And then, oh, I know, he got up, and he said, my name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought to myself, well, good God, we don't all want to know. I mean, you know, I mean, surely there's some things you keep to yourself, really. So, but anyway, after Don got down, two other fellows got up and told equally as fascinating stories. I was so intrigued, and I think I could end my qualification there. I think that is what qualifies me as an alcoholic. I think if you like coming to these meetings and you like listening to how people ruin their lives, you know, woke up on bathroom floors, vomited on their clients, lost their families, and you find it fascinating, there's something the matter with you. You know, I found it fascinating, and it's now 33 years later, and I still find it intriguing, and I like to get on the phone and talk about it, and I like to go to coffee shops and talk about it. I find it endlessly interesting, my story and your story and everyone's story, all the intricacies. You know the story I just told you about the guy with the days, and you know, and I heard a story not so long ago of this woman she was so drunk, she came home to her apartment, and she had the key in her apartment, in her hand, and she knew that somehow the key was involved in the door opening. And she didn't quite know how the key and the door related to each other and how it opened. And she was standing in front of the door waving and chanting like this. So, you know. Anyway, so after the meeting, I went back to Bemelman's bar, and what did I understand about anonymity? I didn't understand about the sacredness of anonymity. I thought it was a jolly good job you were anonymous. You should keep quiet about what you got up to. But I didn't understand that, and I told people, my friends at the bar, you'd never guess who is an alcoholic. And I told them details about their story. Anyway, so life is carrying on for me, and it's disintegrating, and we really can't see, you know, once we take one step down on the ladder, the next step doesn't look so far and all that. And, you know, I had this very big job. I was the first woman art auctioneer in America, and I had this very, very public job. And I think the only thing that kept me in it was this accent. You know, I was too young really to be eccentric. But I could see when I got sober, I could see that I was on the verge of losing it. My boss would have called me and he would have said, you know, Lorna, you're very good at what you do and you make a lot of money for the company. But we never know what you're going to do next, what you're going to say next, how you're going to come to work dressed next. You're a loose cannon. And while you might be fantastic, we could do with someone a little less fantastic. And we're going to have to let you go. It's too dicey. There's too much money, you know, on you. So, and they would never have said to me, we're letting go because you drink too much. No one ever said anything to me about my drinking. No one ever mentioned my drinking. But they said things like, shh. And, you know, do you mind? And what you said was very spiteful. And really, Lorna, that's not really appropriate to wear that outfit, you know, plunging necklines at funerals and things. So it was very difficult. My life was getting shabbier and shabbier and shabbier. You know, at the end of my drinking, I was desperately unhappy about the husband and the marriage breaking up, torn to pieces. But I was seeing someone else that I that I wanted to marry. The fact that he hadn't even mentioned it, it seemed to pose no problem whatsoever. And I wanted to marry him because he had the one thing in the world I wanted. And that was not a great love of me. That was not fine manners or a noble character. No. He had a maid. And I was desperate for the maid. And, you know, I was a very heavy smoker in those days, and every chair you sat in, there was a little table next to it, and it had a little silver container of loose cigarettes, an ashtray, and a lighter that worked. And I wanted someone to brush my hair, to lay my clothes out, to tell me when to get up, when to go to sleep, to run my bath. I was too busy, you understand, just too busy to take care of myself. And I wanted the maid. And, you know, I often say that I was willing to let that fellow touch the sacred temple in order to get to the maid. And in some circles, that's called prostitution. See? See? So life was a little tawdry and a little shabby. At the very end of, but that was, it was all in the sort of leading up to the summer of 76. In July of 76, so it was the end of June, I went to England with my company, and at that, there was a big gathering, and the Sotheby's had a very big dinner dance at one of the smart London hotels. And it was all the, you know, the important collectors and Lord and Lady Duwar Diddy and God knows who were there. And I was all done up in a gown, and but I hadn't washed my hair, you know. I just pulled it back in a bun. I'll never forget. Anyway, I was all done up in this gown. And while they were dancing, I was going from table to table, emptying their glass into mine. And something clicked. I thought, you know, my behavior doesn't really suit my position in the company. And but then the alcoholism makes an excuse. It says, oh, well, you know, it's you after all. You know, you're special, you're different, and they wouldn't understand, and it's perfectly fine. And that summer of 1976, I'd gone to Paris to see The Lover. And it was, it sounds grand, but believe me, it was so tawdry, icky. I mean, let's face it, we're never going out with the cream of the crop at the end of our drinking, you know. And and probably for the first 5 years of sobriety. So, so I got up to Paris to see this fellow and come back, and it was just terrible. And I wanted to come back to America because it was America's bicentennial. And I wanted to see those tall ships going up the Hudson River. It was a big deal. And I, you know, we say in the program that we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. There's some things I very much regret. I really regret, you know, lost opportunities. And my father was standing at the garden gate waving goodbye to me as I went off to London Airport in the taxi cab. And I was so caught up in myself, self, and my disastrous, you know, life, and my, I was 30 years old, and the tragedy of my life, and my broken marriage, and this, you know, horror in Paris, and that, and I couldn't be bothered to wave goodbye. I was sort of like, yeah, yeah, bye. And it was the last time I was to see my father. He died very suddenly, and I regret that. I regret it. So it makes me very aware of when I'm with someone to try and be with them. You know, not be, especially these days, not be multitasking when I'm with them, not to be on the telephone or to be doing something, to be with you. You know, if I suddenly had a heart attack and you'd be the last person, you'd be the most important person in my life. So, my drinking story is actually peppered with missed opportunities. I came to America when I was 18 years old, and up until that time, on Sunday nights, my girlfriends and I, we would go to this place called the Station Hotel in Richmond, and it was Richmond on the Thames, and it was sort of a seedy has-been hotel, but there was this wonderful rock band that used to play on Sunday nights, and the leader of this rock band had a bit of a crush on me. He liked me, and he wanted to go out with me, but I had my eyes set on America, and I came to America, and the name of that band was the Rolling Stones. So, you know, Mick and I might not have walked off into the sunset, but it would have been a good notch on the belt, don't you agree? So I missed out, you know, and I always missed. I went into miniskirts the years Max's came out. I was always wrong. You know, alcoholics were always whining. Oh, I never felt like I fit in. I never felt like I was given the rule book for life. Well, we don't fit in. You know, we just don't. And for my sake, you know, I was a jagged scream in the world. And I just didn't fit in. I was just wrong. And anyway, I came back to New York expressly to see those tall ships. And I live on the island of Manhattan. It's an island. And the thing that defines an island is it's a piece of land surrounded by water. I just had to walk left or right, and eventually I would have hit a river. I did not know where the river was. And I spent the entire 4th of July, 1976, by myself and drinking. And the whole of America was celebrating, and I missed it. So, it took me about 27 years of sobriety to really get in touch with the depth of my isolation. And here I was, 30 years old. Why was I so isolated? I was working in a business where there were loads and loads of people. And, why didn't I have anyone to, why didn't I go with anyone? I can't imagine, why not. There's a whole group of guys come in. Would people that are sitting next to an empty chair put their hand up? So there's plenty of empty seats if you guys want to sit, all right? Because it's going to be a long haul here. Yeah. So, and there's two in the front row down here. Yeah, there's plenty over this side. I know they probably all want to be together. Yes. So where was I up to? Are you paying attention? Oh, the tall ships, the tall ships. That's right. So, very shortly after that, I had a girlfriend staying with me overnight. She was from out of town. And we got up in the morning, and I couldn't wait to get rid of her. And as soon as she'd gone, went down to the bodega, and I bought myself a container of Tropicana orange juice. And I made a jug, a carafe of vodka and orange juice. And I poured myself a tumbler full of this stuff. And as I took a drink of it, for the first time I said, this is a drink in the morning. I am drinking in the morning. This is a morning drink. And it is said, I always say, it's an ancient Chinese saying, but you've never even heard of a modern Chinese saying, but they're all ancient. But they say, the beginning of wisdom is to call something by its correct name. Now, I'd had a drink in the morning many, many times, but I'd called it brunch. I'd called it a gallery opening, toasting the bride, summertime on the beach, Wednesday or something. And I lived in Spain for a short while one year, and I had cognac in my coffee every morning, and I called it continental. So I'd had drinks in the morning many times, but this was the first time I identified it, and I said, this is a morning drink. And I had a brunch date with the Paris lover, and the guy with the maid, and I got in the shower, and I could not release that glass from my hand. Now, I was a heavy smoker, and I tried to give up smoking 10,000 times. I'd stopped smoking so many times. And I was a sort of smoker. I could never take a puff of a cigarette and put it in the ashtray and talk, and then pick it up and take another puff and put it. No, once I lit it, it was in my fingers the entire time. And then I got so that I had a Dunhill cigarette holder so I could keep it clamped to my teeth like a Nazi the whole time. So I suddenly it clicked with me that I couldn't, this was like cigarettes, I could not release the glass. And I think God looked out from heaven and went, oy vey, this one, when's she ever going to... I have a very New York God. So I couldn't. Anyway, I got myself ready, and I went off for this date. And I drank some more, a lot more. And we argued, and we had a terrible time, and I ended up on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I don't know if any of you have been to New York and seen that. It was a beautiful summer Sunday afternoon, and those steps lead up to the museum, and people are always sitting on it, and there were tourists going in and out of the museum, and vendors selling T-shirts and God knows what, and life was happening. Life was all around me, and very gay, and very wonderful New York scene. And I could see it, and I couldn't get to it. I felt like there was this huge lucite wall around me, and I could see that it was life, but I couldn't feel it. And I have never, up till that moment, I had never been able to identify that screaming loneliness like I felt then. I felt far worse in sobriety, but it was the first time I was conscious of it, that terrible desolation, and I didn't know what to do. And I remember standing up, and I, you know, the sun wasn't going to set for a long time. It was summer. I hadn't been invited out anywhere for a long time, and I was 30 years old and so young and so alone. And the thought came to me, go to one of those meetings. And I went to a meeting at the Moravian Church at 30th and Lexington. And it was the sort of meeting that one, in one's fantasy, imagines an AA meeting was going to be like. It was in a basement of a church. It was hot. There was no air conditioning. It was August. It was very Salvation Army. There were guys there with overcoats on in the middle of August. The only thing that was missing were the tambourines. I mean, it was really a low bottom. But I'd had all this drink, all this vodka on this particular Sunday. And I didn't want to make a big fuss, so I just sat down. And a woman got up to speak. And she was my sort of build, but she looked very used. And to me, in my eyes at that time, you know, like this, she looked a bit of a hag. And I think it was God coming to me in that form. And she told my story up to where I was at that very moment. And then she went on for another 15 years. And you know how when you're 16, you can't possibly imagine being 30. I mean, 30 is like, 30-year-olds are another species. You're never going to be 30. You can't think that far ahead. And you can't imagine you in your youth being old. And I was given the grace in that moment to see that that woman and I were exactly the same. And the only thing separating us was moment by moment by moment by moment. And that I got to see coming attractions. That was my life. And I knew I was her and she was me. And I said to myself, oh my God, I drink. It's drinking. It's not the marriage or the lover or the job or my smoking or whatever it was that I lay, or my weight. It was nothing. I drink. I'm here. It dawned on me, God Almighty, I've been coming to these meetings because it's me. And I think the angels flop back on the clouds going, oh. You know, finally, she's got it. And that idea was so horrific to me, I ran out onto Lexington Avenue, went into the nearest bar, and knocked a few more back. And I don't know what happened, but anyway, the following day, I woke up in my own bed, in my own apartment, and there I was. And that night, I went to a meeting that I'd been to, as an open meeting. I walked in, and I said, I'm here for myself, and thus began my journey. And, you know, I didn't know in the beginning how you knew I was new. I didn't know what betrayed me as new. And in the beginning, when I used to speak, I used to think... I used to think at the end of my talk, God, the next time I speak, I must get my story straight. And there's no getting it straight because it changes all the time. And even after 33 years, I see it differently. And it's constantly being revealed to me. Not always my drinking story, but certainly my sober story. And anyway, I had many different feelings when I came in about this whole thing. And one of them was, I thought you took one look at me and you nudged each other and you said, well, Thank God Lorna has arrived, because she adds great tone and class to AA, you know? Now we can hold our heads up high, and we can, she will lead us out of the darkness of anonymity into the sunlight of fame. And in reality, what was happening was you were patting me on the back and you were saying, sweetheart, you keep coming back, all right? You're in the right place. And I didn't know what it was that betrayed me as a newcomer. Maybe it was the fact that I had been wearing the same dress for the past 3 months. And I had coal around my eyes, black coal. And because I couldn't be content with a dainty little line, I looked like one of those, you know, I played for the Jets or something. I had black coal, because I thought you couldn't really see my eyes. And I had my hair that I tried not to wash too much because it was too much of a palaver. I had it in tight braids across the top of my head. I fancied I looked like Heidi, but I look more like, you know, a mental patient. And you knew I was new. And I always say, you know, I had gobs of makeup on. Gobs. And I was festooned with jewelry. I had jewelry on all over the place. I mean, the day, I know people wear lots of rings and earrings and all that, but in those days it was not quite so fashionable. I looked like I should be, you know, reading your fortune or something. But instead of an art expert. But I always say how grateful I am that I came into the program before the trend of tattooing and piercing came about, because I'm sure I would have had the Last Supper put on my chest, or you know, or the entire crucifixion scene with Roman soldiers and weeping mothers and things. And of course, I would not have been content with a delicate little stud in my nose. I probably would have had a plate in my lower lip. I just am so grateful, because I know jolly well I would have done something to myself. And for anyone in the room that's new, you know, I want to tell you that they say no major changes in the first year, and getting a piercing and a tattoo is a major change. So think about it. You know, I love tattoos, and people have, this woman sitting in front of me has got some very pretty ones. But it's something to consider. And of course, we never consider anything. You know, what do our sponsors know? And anyway, so I'm in AA, and I have this arrogant feeling, and at the same time as that, I have this feeling of, oh my God, you know, I hope they don't discover that I'm not an alcoholic. I hope they don't ask me how to make a martini or something, because I don't know, and I hope they don't kick me out. And I had this fear that one of you that was, you know, had probably praying hand cufflinks or something, was going to come up to me and say, listen, sister, we're a busy organization, and exactly how much have you drunk after all? And we notice you always sit in the front row and you eat an awful lot of cookies, and do you mind? And I thought you were going to kick me out. So I had this thing going on all the time. Anyway, I got a sponsor. I got a woman to help me. And she wasn't at all like me at all, and she had no class. She wanted to meet me at 6 o'clock in the evening for a meal in a coffee shop. I didn't even know they sold meals in coffee shops. And she was punching out tickets of Pan Am. And she wore a polyester skirt, and she carried a plastic handbag. And she'd been in the convent. She was an escapee from nunhood. And she was a mafia princess. Her father was in the garbage disposal business. But Kathy, I was fascinated with her because this is what she had that I wanted. She had the ability to say no thank you without explaining her entire life. She had the ability to say, I've changed my mind, I won't be able to make it. I mean, I just found that out. I didn't know how to have coffee with you without giving you keys to my apartment. I didn't know. And I was so intrigued. And of course, I was so intrigued that she was a former nun, because I'd been raised by nuns and I wanted to know what they got up to and what they wore under those habits and all that sort of stuff. So that's become. And Ella knew that she could not talk to me about my drinking. She knew I couldn't, even though I'd had that epiphany in that meeting, she knew that I didn't grasp the fact that I drank. I thought for the longest time I'd nipped it in the bud, that I got in here before it got really bad, that I wasn't a really bad alcoholic, that I was very smart, as a matter of fact, because I could see that I had tendencies towards alcoholism, but that I'd come in before I developed it. And I wasn't really an alcoholic. So she knew she couldn't talk to me about, you better do steps, this, that, and the other. No way. I wasn't brought up like that at all. But I did know my life was tawdry. I did know and recognize it was shabby and second rate. And I longed to have I worked with great works of art. I met and moved in amazing circles, and I knew I was not a class act. I was raised as a class act, but I knew I wasn't it anymore. And Ellen said to me, Lorna, if you stay with us and follow our suggestions, you will be able to develop a life that will be like having a quiver of golden arrows on your back. And when you come into a situation in life that you're not too sure how to handle, you'll be able to reach back, select the perfect bow, put it in your bow, fire, and hit your target every time. And that idea of hitting my target every time was so intoxicating to me. I was never quite right. I was always off. The idea of being appropriate in the world, of laughing appropriately, speaking appropriately, was mesmerizing to me, and that's what I wanted. And I knew you had it. I knew that somehow this going on in here was the A1 class act. And I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it. And within 20 minutes of getting sober, I knew that to be silent was my key. And within 20 minutes of being sober, I was meditating. I knew it. I knew to be quiet. I wanted to be quiet. And I had a tendency to be quiet. In any case, I know I speak a lot, but I also go away for very, very long silent retreats. And so it really appealed to me. I didn't realize I drank for 2 years into sobriety. I didn't realize I had alcoholism. As I said, I thought I nipped it in the bud. And it took me 2 years to grasp that I hadn't nipped it in the bud at all. I always thought there was this safe cushion around me. You know, I'd never woken up in bed with some strange person, which I was sort of looking forward to. And I'd never, you know, there were certain drinks I'd never had. There were certain things. I thought I had this safe cushion. And, you know, around 2 years, I realized I have no safe cushion. I have no safe sip of alcohol, tab of acid, snort of cocaine, hit of marijuana. I have not one safety in that left for me. And I got in here by the skin of my teeth. And so here I am, and I'm bouncing along in sobriety. And sobriety is life, and life happens to me. So I'd like to get on and talking about the last section of my life. No, I hope it's not the last section of my life. these last few years. I Yes, I would like it. Could you open it for me? Let me take a look before we get into chapter 2. Thank you so much. In May of 2007, I was involved in a very hideous car crash, five-car pileup, and I was actually on my way to a long retreat. And after that retreat, I came out, and I went and got the mammogram that I had cancelled before I went on retreat and before I had that car crash. And then the mammogram, blah, 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 and it turns out that I had lumps in my breast, and they turned out to be malignant. And in July of 2007, I had a double mastectomy. And actually, I just want to take a break here and say I would ask you to please, I know I'm eminently huggable, but please don't hug me. It's a little tender and emotionally, so I'd rather not be hugged. And so I had this double mastectomy, and then I... after, I'm just going to try and go in the sequence like this. So that was like the very, very end of July. And then I have to walk around with all these drains coming out of my chest from the wounds from the surgery. And I was in a meeting one day, and this girl comes running in, and she said to me, "Lorna, look at this." And she was an actress, and she had Variety or something. And she said, "This looks like you." And it said, it was advertisements for all sorts of roles they wanted filled, dancers on Broadway and roles and things, anything to do with the theater. And it said, "Sex and the City movie." It said, "Auctioneer. Female, 50s to 60s, should be or have been a real auctioneer. British is a plus." So I called the number and the casting director, and I said, "You know, look, I'm not an actress, but I fit this description perfectly." And so she said, "Well, come along for an audition." So I went along for this audition. I was the only person there. And it was a great struggle to get up, but every single day I wanted to do one thing that would get me out of the house and get me moving and make me get dressed and get me going, because I was really, you know, in a bad way. And so I went for this audition, and, you know, I did my little bit. I did what I do. I auctioned something. And then they said, "Thank you very much. We'll be in touch." Typical sort of thing. They did a video. They take a video of you. And on a cam camera, I guess that's what it is. And then I struggled home again, thinking, "Oh, well, that was that in that day. You know, that was my little outing in that day." So then... my chemotherapy is due to start in the September. So I was told that after the second round of chemotherapy, my hair would fall out. Then, so chemo is scheduled. Just, I think it was like the day before the chemotherapy, I got a phone call, and it was from the casting director. And she said, "We'd like to offer you the part." I said, "You're joking." And she said, "No." So I said, "Oh my God." I said, "How important is my look?" And she said, "It's very important." So I said, "Well, look, I better get straight with you. I said, I'm just starting chemotherapy, and in 2 weeks, my hair's going to fall out." And she said, "Oh, just a minute. We'll get back to you." So she called me back, and she said the director would still like you to use, and they changed the entire shooting schedule to get me before my hair fell out. And I have this tiny role. You know, if any of you have seen the movie Sex and the City, I'm the auctioneer. I'm in the first 15 minutes of it. So when you see that movie, you'll think, "Oh, 4 days later, her hair fell out." And anyway, I did this. It was a speaking part and all that, and I was a key piece in this movie on the big screen there. So I want to say to you, you know, that here I am, a woman of a certain age. I'm in my 60s. I had no breasts. I was about to go bald, and I'm in a sex movie. I'm finally a bimbo. So don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. So then what happened? Oh, I want to talk about, I'm in the middle of writing, not in the middle, I've written a new book, it's in the editing process. And there's a chapter in it called Crisis in Kentucky. And I want to talk about this. Very shortly, I had a terrible, terrible problem with the chemotherapy. I was in the emergency room 4 times in hospital for long stays. I had clots on my lungs. It was very bad. People were told, if you want to see Lorna, you better make an effort and get to the hospital to see her. I was not expected to make it. And the last thing was my heart went into failure, and they put a defibrillator in my chest. So that's another reason I'm not keen to be hugged. And that's why I like to sit down, because I was in Las Vegas speaking, and I collapsed in my room. And you can be assured, and when the defibrillator goes off, it vaults you forward, so, you know, I hope I don't vault into the front row. That's why I like to sit down. And also so you can see my pretty ankles. And then all this trouble and all this stuff, and of course I'd been under anesthesia, and I was having drugs, and I was having, it was a whole big deal. And then I was getting better and better and better. And I was getting very much better, and I was invited to speak on a cruise. And I was getting myself ready to go on this cruise, and I was doing some errands, and I walked down Madison Avenue on a beautiful, beautiful October day, crisp and lovely, and I tripped on the pavement and fell and broke my knee, smashed my knee. And that made my double mastectomy feel like a manicure. It was so painful. So the cruise went out the window, and but I had been invited to this Epicurean dinner in November. November came, and I was still in a soft cast and on crutches and in a lot of pain. But nothing was going to stop me from this Epicurean dinner. And I went because I ride, and there was in Kentucky, and there were going to be a lot of horsey people at this dinner, and I wanted to go and chat and all that sort of thing. So the universe was telling me not to go, but, you know, barging through the stop signs. I struggle through the airport, and I get down to Kentucky, and I'm the guest in this fabulous home, great big home that had been, lots of presidents had slept in and God knows what. And it was beautiful. I had called the host before, and I said, look, I can't take alcohol in any form. I can't have it in a glass. I can't have it in my food. I can't have it in any form whatsoever. So it was all handled very nicely. And what happened in the evening, there were about 18 guests, and it was at one of these long mahogany tables with the silver candelabra and the flowers and the linens and, you know, the silverware and the beautiful porcelain and the cut glass stemware, and it was just lovely. And I noticed in front of everyone else had a battery of wine glasses in front of their place, and in front of mine was a single glass which was constantly replenished with Pellegrino. And I noticed that sometimes my dish was a little different from my neighbor's because it was cooked in a different sauce. It was very quietly, very elegantly handled. And the evening was very nice. We had lovely conversation, very nice. It was a two-night affair. So the second day was Saturday morning. I got up and I met a friend of mine who lived in that same area, who's in the program, and she took me to a meeting. So I went to a meeting. I went out for breakfast with her. I talked about this dinner and how interesting it was, and she knew a lot of the people that were there. And then the second night comes, all right? And what happened was, it was many courses, the dinner, and there were five chefs. And the chef would come out of the kitchen and explain what the dish was that was being served at that particular time and why he or she had chosen the particular wine to go with that dish. Fine. So, we're about four courses in on the second night, and the pasta is served. And the wine is poured. And the woman sitting opposite me suddenly goes, "Oh my God, this wine is fantastic." And she turns to the host and says, Charlie, whatever his name was, it wasn't his name, but that was the fictive, "Charlie, every wine has been superb, but this wine is amazing." And he got caught up with her rhapsodizing on about the wine, and he told her where he got it, if it came from his own cellar, and la la la, and they're talking about this wine. And then she zeroes in on me across the table. And she says, "Lorna, are you not drinking?" Now, I would have noticed hours before if someone wasn't drinking. So I said, "No, I'm not drinking." And she said, "Well, I don't usually drink, but this wine," she said, "it's amazing. And what it does to the pasta is extraordinary." And the disease came slithering across the table. It came slithering around the candelabra, over the crystalware, over my plate, up my bosom, nestled against my ear, and it hissed, "Lorna, it's not a slip. You just want to enhance the pasta." You wouldn't, it's not about your sobriety. Do you want to miss this experience? You don't want to miss out on this experience. And I knew I was going to drink. I knew I was going to pick that drink up because there were many waiters around, people serving, and all I had to do was say, "I've changed my mind. I would like to taste that particular wine." And it would have been at my setting like that. And it is said in our literature that there will come a time when there's nothing stands between you and a drink except your higher power. And my higher power in that moment was 32 years. It happened last year, so I was 32 years old. 32 years of sitting in AA meetings every day. I consider myself a daily meeting goer. And I had no intentions of not drinking. I had every intention of enhancing the pasta. And something in me, something born in me, something higher than myself took over. And I leant back in my chair just like that. No big movement. I didn't push away from the table. I just leant back in my chair like that. I put my cutlery down. I folded my hands in my lap. And I just sat there for a moment in another dimension. I just sat there. It was a brief moment, maybe 20 seconds, something like that. The moment passed, I pushed myself back up off the chair back, I picked up my cutlery and I kept on eating. And the moment passed and I never ordered that drink. And it went out of my mind, it was gone. I never thought about it. And the next day I was packing to come back to New York, and that whole scene, the whole reel of film went through my mind, and I broke down and wept. I wept and wept. I couldn't believe. I never thought a slip would appear like that. I always thought a slip would be, you make a decision to have a slip. And then you're breaking through barriers that things are saying no, 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 but you're bashing through. It was so sweet and easy. And no big deal. And cunning. And baffling. And insidious. I really understood it. And you know, I'm considered to have good sobriety. What the hell is good sobriety, really? You know, my disease is doing, as they say, doing push-ups in the hallway. My disease is very virulent. I've got 33 years of continuous sobriety. It's very virulent. But in taking an inventory of myself, what the hell was I doing at an Epicurean dinner? You know, I don't care whether they were talking about horses or whether they were even offering me a horse. I had no business taking my darling diamond sobriety into a drinking situation. I do not belong there. I am in the world, but I am not of the world. And unless I have a good reason to be there, I do not belong. I do not belong taking this precious gift into that. I'm a shining light in the world. I'm supposed to attract people, not go into that darkness. And also, and I want to address this for long-term sobriety. Because this incident caused me a lot of thinking. And you know, for 2 years prior to that, I'd been, when we're in longer term sobriety, we tend to focus very much on the moral part of our lives, on the 10th step and meditation and prayer and making amends and doing service and sponsoring and all that sort of thing. And I think for me, what had happened, the physical went away. I'd forgot that I also have a physical disease. And I'd been through hell. My vehicle had been through hell. And I'd had, you know, major surgery. I'd broken my knee. I'd been on masses of painkillers. I'd been under anesthesia several times. Been under anesthesia three times with the mastectomy, the defibrillator, and my knee. And, you know, I was worn down. I was just so worn down. I'd fallen down the stairs three times. You know, people in the meetings were going, oh my God, would you stop having accidents? It was just, you know, we can't take it anymore. You can't take it. What about me? I'm the one having it. But, and I hadn't taken into account that I was, you know, I was struggling. I was on crutches, for God's sakes, and I got myself to that drinking situation. So, you know, it really blew me away, and that was Thanksgiving, and I have a very dear friend in New York, and he was having a New Year's Eve party. He was a program member, and I called him and said, are you going to be serving alcohol? He said, I have friends that will be there that don't drink, and I will be serving alcohol. I said, I must decline. I will not come. And how much longer do I have? What? No, I don't, because she's got a tape there. But I want to say this, you know, I feel very strongly about this. So I'm going to say it. It might cause a lot of controversy, but I'm old enough now, so I don't care. And when I was early in sobriety, I was told to get the alcohol out of my house. And I got it out of the house. And very early, about 10 months sober, I had an accident in the house. And a piece of metal went right through my thumbnail. And my computer of Alcoholics Anonymous crashed, went down. I had no program, no sponsor, no steps, no big book, no nothing. I went to the cupboard to get out the vodka, and it wasn't there, because I'd gotten the alcohol out of the house. And I am very, very about getting the alcohol out of the house. People will say, well, just because I've stopped drinking doesn't mean to say I want to impose that on my friends. And when they come over, I want to be able to offer them a drink. People that don't smoke don't keep cartons of cigarettes in their house. And the you know, Orthodox Jews don't have the odd shrimp cocktail around, and Muslims don't have a side of pork in the freezer. And I don't know about you, but I've yet to go to someone's house, and they have on their coffee table little piles of cocaine and heroin and the works, and they say, and they have syringes, and they say, oh, well, we don't shoot up, but maybe you'd like to, you know? So, and I want to say this very emphatically, that any alcoholic who has alcohol in their house, no matter for what reason they say it's there, it's got their name on it. And if you're with a loving, significant other, that significant other is going to be only too happy for you not to have alcohol in the house. It's a matter of life and death. I have a cousin, and she has a son that was allergic to nuts, deathly allergic to nuts, you know, couldn't breathe it, cut something in his throat. Well, how much is that? What is that? 10 more minutes. And there wasn't a nut to be found in that house or within 10-mile radius. And she didn't say, oh, well, that's his problem. I can eat nuts and the other kids can eat nuts. He's just going to have to read labels. No nuts anywhere. Anyway, I want to get on to the last part of my story because I know a lot of you want to hear this and I might not get it on the tape. But a lot of you know that I was very close with Mother Teresa. And Mother Teresa was fascinated with Alcoholics Anonymous, fascinated, and always wanted to talk to me about it. And sometimes I'd say to her, you sure you don't have a problem? I mean, you know... You always want to talk about this. And Mother recognized that she had success with every form of suffering human, but she could not help the alcoholic. And she could not help the alcoholic because she didn't have the words of eternal life that you and I have. And those words are, I know how you feel. Let me tell you what happened to me. And one time, this was a few years before Mother actually died, she was very ill in hospital. And I dashed over to Calcutta to see her. We all thought it was going to be the last one. I went into the hospital room, and it was a very, very small room. And Mother's in bed. And I hadn't been there. She was very thrilled to see me. It was a great shock. And I hadn't been there very long when a young priest came in to say Mass. And they set up the table at the bottom of the bed. And he stood at the foot of the bed and faced Mother and said Mass. So I'm squashed in the bed next to Mother. I'm not in the bed. I'm squashed... standing next to the bed. I'm not in her bed. And there's another nun standing beside me, Sister Monica, and there were two other sisters squashed in on the other side. I don't know why it was such a small room, but it was. Then it came time for communion, and he came around the side of the bed, and he dipped the host in the chalice of wine, and Mother pushed herself up from the pillows, very reverentially took the host on her tongue, and sat back again. And then it was me. And the thought went through my mind, oh God, not here. Please don't let me have to make a fuss here. I mean, don't make a fuss, Lorna, always bringing the attention onto yourself while this woman the world considers a saint is dying in bed next to you. You know, she's in her 90. Just don't make it all about you. Take it for God's sakes. It's the blood of Jesus. And so it's not wine. It's sacred. And then I thought, you know, those nanoseconds, I thought of all those that had gone before me. I thought of the glorious story of Bill W. in the Mayflower Hotel. When heaven held its breath, which way will he go? And heaven, and it matters what you and I do. It matters how we choose. It matters what we do in those hidden moments in our lives. And we never know the ramifications of our seemingly hidden actions. And I thought of all the thousands that have gone before me and all the millions that will come after me. And my story matters. It matters. and it matters how I choose. And I said to him, no wine, please. And he's very flustered. But anyway, he's holding up the dripping host already, and he gives it to Sister Monica. And I said, well, I would like communion, but please don't dip it in the chalice. So he gives me communion, and I take it. Excuse me. But by now, I'm totally... You know, I'm feeling awkward, I'm feeling weird, I've destroyed Mother's devotions, I've brought all the attention onto myself and my bloody disease and, you know, all that. And Mother's hand came across the cover, and she took my hand and she pulled me down to her, and she said, well done, you must continue to protect your precious gift. So I want to say to you all that you and I have a precious gift. It's not a light thing that you and I have. And it is not given to us for ourselves alone. This is not a gift given to us so that we can be wonderful and grand and terrific. It's given to us to raise the dead. When people ask me, what do? I say, I raise the dead. That's what I do. You know, my career is raising the dead. Building empires is what I do on the side. And you and I are called to a great, great calling. And we are very, very blessed to be, you know, I'm not always in love with sobriety. I don't wake up every morning madly grateful to be sober. But I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in love with the fact that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I get to be with you. So I want to thank you for asking me to speak. I want to thank you for doing service, for being my friend, for running me all over town today, for doing the literature, for all the people that organize this. I want to thank you for what you do in your groups, for never, ever letting the basket pass by without contributing. If you don't have money, throw your watch in, do something. And I want to thank you for all that you do, because if you weren't here, I would have absolutely nowhere to go. So thank you deeply for your sobriety. Thank you.